Who was both the strongest and weakest man in all the Bible? Welcome to The Good Word, a weekly radio program which explores issues of faith. Our current series focuses on Old Testament couples. My name is Paul Dibdahl, and my conversation partners today are Zdravko Stefanovic, professor of the Old Testament, and Carl Kosart, professor of the New Testament. And we are all three colleagues and friends in the School of Theology at Walla Walla University. Welcome to both of you. Thank you for being with us today.
Glad to be here again.
Thank you.
The title of our lesson is Samson and His Women, The Folly of Passion. And the scripture focus is in the book of Judges, chapters 14, 15, and 16. Now, I think it's fair to say that Samson is depicted as perhaps the most physically powerful man in the Bible. And one might also argue that he is someone who also shows incredible weakness as well. In fact, he's often viewed as a man who is ruled by passion and blinded by his infatuation. When we normally think of Delilah. I wonder, though, is passion necessarily a bad thing? Can we think of even entire books in the Bible which seem rather passionate in nature? And by passion, I'm even thinking of passionate, a kind of relationship between a man and a woman.
Song of Solomon has to qualify as probably the most passionate in that sense book in the Old Testament and Bible, as far as that goes. And one that's often very controversial, too, and how it's understood, because people are uncomfortable with that idea of kind of a passion being sacred, even. Almost just more earthly, fleshly, and questionable than positive. Yet, we find it in the book of Song of Solomon.
Why would the title of this lesson, again supplied to us, be The Folly of Passion? Is passion necessarily foolishness? Is it necessarily dangerous? Is it okay to celebrate the passionate part of romantic love? Go ahead, Carl.
We might want to call it the folly of unrestrained passion. Because I think passion itself can be good, but it also can become very, very, very negative as well.
Okay, so passion is okay, but not too much. Enough that it is not become overwhelming, or that our mind does not somehow rule our passion. Is that fair to say?
And the problem was also that Samson lived in a very hostile environment. There were Philistine enemies around, but somehow he liked to walk on the line between his people and the Philistines. And some of the decisions that he made while on walking on that line, they were driven more by passion than principles and so on. And that's where the danger comes in. To be passionate within some well-defined limits, it's safer than he was testing some things too much with a lot of passion that he could no longer control, and that turned out to go against him.
There seems to have been a dichotomy between his personal life and his vocation in that sense, where he looked at, you know, as the judge and defending his people, they were very serious, but when it came down to his own personal inner life, his own pleasures, he was far more, he wasn't as cautious as he was.
Yeah, it may not be. Zdravko was very kind of careful in saying he was on the line. It may be that he even went across the line on a frequent basis. I want to come back once more to this question of passion. Is there such a thing as love without passion? I was going to add to that, but I'll wait. I'm trying to defend passion just a bit here.
Well, I guess in the context of our quarterly, we have talked about arranged marriage. Where is passion in an arranged marriage? I suppose it could be there, but it may not be there. So, once again, it depends on how you define love as well, right, in a sense of marriage.
Okay. So, Well, I did have one other thing, and then we'll, I may be belaboring this point too much. Should marriage, let's go back to the kind of the arranged marriage issue again. Should marriage be entered into as a result of, you know, logic, rationality, or does emotion and passion, or should emotion and passion play a part in a person's decision as to who they marry?
Well, I don't know. It depends too. I'm going back to your second question.
Okay.
I mean, can it be love without passion? Can love be passionless?
Passionless. Yeah. Yeah.
It seems to me no, in a sense. I mean, love is not just some sort. I mean, love is a constant, but passion seems almost inherent with love. So to separate the two and say passion no, or I don't think it's a fair separation.
Okay.
I will qualify my answer as subjective. I believe that that passion is an essential ingredient. The only question is how much does it show? Mm. And also, I have noticed that at various points in my life, you know, I would experience and demonstrate more of passion. At other times, I would think of, you know, clear judgment and, mm-hmm. and the decisions that I can make somewhat devoid of emotions. So I believe that all that is present within a person, but mm-hmm. under various circumstances, mm-hmm. you know, we put emphasis okay. on different aspects. Yes.
And maybe it is kind of unfair, you know, three PhD-educated aging men to have us talk about passion, and even for me to ask questions about, maybe a bit unfair. I'm not sure that we're qualified to really. Maybe we are.
I was waiting for you to give us the answers.
Yes, well, I'm the one to ask questions, Carl. And here's the next one. Samson, back to Samson again. He was set aside as a Nazirite from birth. First of all, what did it mean to be set aside as a Nazirite? What was expected in that? And here, Numbers 6 might be of help to us. And then secondly, is that fair that a parent or God even set aside someone for a special task from birth? Where is Samson's freedom in this? What if he didn't want to be a Nazirite? What if he wanted to do something else?
I will explain the first part of the question, and I'll ask Kyle to explain the second.
Okay.
Thank you.
The word Nazirite is related to a Hebrew word that has to do with making a vow, making a promise. And that promise was to stay close to God, and there were some external signs that could be visible on a person, like growing hair. Showing to the people that a person came from a less inhabited place, and not allowing the cutting of hair would mean staying in closer touch with nature, where God dwells, where God is revealed. Then a refusal to accommodate oneself, like the settlers do, especially in the Middle East. So a person typically would stay in a living tent, not to plant a vineyard, which is another sign of settled life in the Middle East, and not to eat grapes or raisins or drink grape juice. The Rechabites are known from the Bible for that, and so on. So all of this in order to show that a person wanted to be closer to nature, closer to God, to be somewhat special, set aside for a service toward God. So, and the Nazirite vow could have been a permanent one for the whole life or for a period of life.
Okay. So it indicated then a kind of unsettledness in the sense that a person would always be prepared to do or to go where God wanted them
right.
to go. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, resistance to settling down okay. and being a part of a settled community. So either nomadic, semi-nomadic, and mm-hmm. once again, it's a custom that still persists in the Middle East.
Okay. What about that second part of that question? What's the right of a parent or of God to sort of decide before a child has the chance to decide what it is the child will do, the way in which they will live their life.
It's an interesting question. We have several cases in Scripture where case of Jeremiah, where he set aside before he was born. You have the case of the Apostle Paul in Galatians, mm-hmm. chapter 1, where he says, I was set apart from my mother's womb. Although I don't think he would have said that maybe when he was persecuting Christians. I mean, there's mm-hmm. obviously a sense of revelation that unfolded to him, and he saw his purpose in life. With Samson, though, it's different. I mean, it's different in a sense, I think. This would almost today perhaps be the equivalent of saying, not that you're just special, because like all of us are special, and God has a purpose for everyone. But in a sense, this would almost be like me saying to my son, God told us that you're supposed to be a monk.
Mm.
I mean, this was the Nazarite, very, very, visual depiction, not simply, but as a purpose for your life. I don't have the answer for why God did that, or how a parent's, choice would be involved in that. We just see the facts of Scripture.
Mm. It is true that this is related possibly to the prayer of the parents, mm-hmm. because the parents did not have a child, and they mm-hmm. they must have prayed about it, and this was an answer that came from God. I think if you look at the bigger picture in the context of the Bible, we learn from other people that child did have a right later on to refuse to follow the instructions received from the parents.
Okay.
So there was a freedom of choice.
Okay.
And that being, you said there's a...
Not to be a Nazarite. Just to be like an ordinary person.
Okay. Now, we have talked about passion in kind of a general way. We looked at Samson's calling. If we were to quickly go over the rest of the story, we would discover that Samson did not live up to it. It seems quite clear he did not live up to the ideals that his parents would have hoped, or even that God would have hoped for him, his full potential. And yet, he serves as judge, rules over Israel for 20 years. Mm. What does that tell us about God's calling, God's grace? And maybe even if we go to the end of the story, where Samson is really paying for his sin, in a sense, are there notes of hope where we see somehow God's graciousness to a leader who has had numerous moral failures?
To me, the greatest hope I see in the story is the fact that they shave Samson's head, they burn his eyes out, yet hair begins to grow again. And that first little piece of fuzz that comes, what a sense of hope that must have been to Samson. God could have cursed him, and mm-hmm. But obviously God's grace is seen in that first little follicle of hair.
Yeah, and that hair was a symbol of God's presence, which indeed did return to him in strength, in power.
Mm.
I wonder sometimes about moral failures that we see in leaders. I think that's a very serious, very serious thing. It's not something that should be covered over or ignored. But I also think that Samson's story shows us that God can still do some amazing things through people in spite of their great failures. And that gives me hope. Well, we've come to the end. Once again, thank you, Zdravko and Carl, for your participation. Thanks also to Susan Michael, our program engineer. And finally, thank you for listening in. For Good Word, this is Paul Dibdahl.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.